From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on the morning of November 9th. America was waking up to a new president-elect, and it was Donald Trump. No matter who you voted for, the result was a surprise for millions. Here in Rochester, one of the first commentaries to publicly be published came with the title, "The Sun Will Come Up in America." It was written for the Democrat and Chronicle by Dr. Marvin McMickle, the president of Colgate Rochester Crozer Divinity School. But it wasn't all sunshine. McMickle recalled some of the darkest periods in our nation's history: the Civil War, the Jim Crow era, divisions over the Vietnam War. He reminded readers that our country survived those times, and so too will it survive the Trump presidency. McMickle attached some caution, however, writing, "There is legitimate concern about what a Trump presidency will involve. Will it be one marked by an earnest attempt to include the cares and concerns of all Americans, black and white, Christians, Jews, Muslims, Hispanic immigrants, and progressive and conservative groups in the country? Or will this presidency unlock a wellspring of resentment among many Americans who are uncomfortable with the nation's increasing racial and ethnic diversity? Will it take on a nationalistic, even xenophobic approach to global affairs? Will health care be preserved for those who had previously been uncovered? If Obamacare is repealed, with what new program will it be replaced? Will a wall be built at the southern border? Will 12 million undocumented immigrants be removed from the country? Will the United States be a beacon of light or a laughingstock on the global stage? Only time will tell," end quote. And that gives us plenty to talk about. My guest for the hour is the man who wrote those words, Dr. Marvin McMickle, who is the president of Colgate Rochester Crozer Divinity School.
It's a mouthful.
I keep reminding myself to get the full. Nice to see you again.
Thank you, Evan. Good to see you, too. Thanks for having me on.
It's 5 weeks since you published that piece. 5 weeks since we woke up on November 9th with the president-elect. And I'm wondering now if you're feeling any different 5 weeks later, Dr. McMickle.
Nothing has changed to make me think that we ought to be deeply concerned about a Trump presidency. I am in a vocation which is always looking to be hopeful and expectant and optimistic, not about human nature, but about divine intervention. So I think the fact that we have survived really harsh and difficult times in the past is a point that I have to remind people of. That we can overcome, we can persevere. But up to this moment, everything that Donald Trump has done in terms of his appointments to his cabinet, up to his continuing exaggeration of the scope and scale of his election, his braggadocia, his going around the country celebrating himself, has revealed the worst of what I would have expected from him.
Where do you draw that distinction between ineffective protest or demonstration and what you called loyal opposition, what you called, you know, the importance of that, the historical model set forward by Dr. King, but so many others as well?
Yeah, I think the loyal opposition has to have a stake in the future of the country. So we don't want this to reduce itself to riots in the street. But we do want to get back to the cherished principles that hold the nation together. So the equal worth of all persons, equal protection under the law, access to every benefit to all citizens that are available only to some. And to the extent that there are people or policies that are standing in the way of that, the loyal opposition has to point to that. So, for instance, I think we're going to need a loyal opposition in the United States Senate when all of these cabinet appointments start to show up, or when Supreme Court nominees start to appear, and somebody is going to have to push back against some of these people and their policies and their positions and their past statements and hold the president and his would-be appointees accountable. They can't just roll over, you know, and let him have everything he wants because he wants it, if in point of fact, in the long run, those policies are going to harm the broader body politic.
I'd like to listen to, if we could, a comment that a caller made on Election Day. Now, this, of course, was before we knew the results of the election, and it was in the middle of the afternoon on November 8th. I think this was a moment that a lot of Americans, and understandably so, were not expecting Donald Trump to win. But this young woman called in, a young woman of color who was explaining why she chose not to vote. In fact, she chose not to register. She didn't wake up on November 8th saying, "Oh, I wish I had registered." She had made a conscious decision. I don't want to be involved in this process. And she wanted to explain why. Now, we hesitate to have any one person, whether it's Marvin McMickle or Shamika, who is the caller you're about to hear, people represent themselves. Sure. I mean, they can't perfectly represent an entire group of Americans. But what she wanted to at least explain was why some, especially some young people, felt disaffected, felt left out of the process, and particularly were not moved to vote for Hillary Clinton. So let's listen to this call, and I'd like to hear Dr. McMickle's response.
The reason why I feel that people are so angry is because they don't have choices. She has not done anything for people of color. She hasn't done anything for Native Americans. So I'm not a registered voter. I will admit that now because I do not want to take part in this system. Mm.
Okay.
Whether she gets a vote or not, whether she wins or not, I feel that it's not. She's not her. A vote for Hillary is not going to change the fact that Donald Trump opened this Pandora box of racism, colonialism, sexism, and all other forms of oppression that's going on right now. So I'm literally afraid for people of color.
Okay, Dr. McMickle. First of all, first thoughts for Shamika, the woman who called that day.
Not to vote is to vote. When you don't vote, when you don't stand up and cast a vote, you have voted. You have voted by your absence. There's an ancient notion that not to decide is to decide. So by her not voting, she has impacted nothing except made it more likely that the very person she was against is going to have a chance to win. It is, for me, preposterous to think that Donald Trump would have been a better outcome for people of color, for Native Americans, and for other oppressed groups than Hillary Clinton. It is not true to say that she has done nothing for people of color. She began her whole career going into Alabama, Mississippi, North Carolina, testing integration in public schools. She worked for the Children's Defense Fund. She voted throughout all of her career to advocate both in Arkansas and then as the First Lady and then as a New York Senator to advocate for the inclusion of all persons. Sure, everybody has a cast a vote here or there with which some of us may disagree. But on the whole, I think it would not be a very persuasive argument to say that the protest that I choose to employ is to not vote at all. That's what Kanye West said, by the way, who appeared with Donald Trump yesterday outside of Trump Tower. Kanye West went on stage in the middle of a concert and said, well, I didn't vote. But if I had voted, I would have voted for Donald Trump. Okay, well, in point of fact, he did vote for Donald Trump because he didn't vote. So I would urge people to not see the failure to vote as a positive action toward the outcome. The only thing we have as Americans, universally, that allows our voice to be heard in these quadrennial events is our vote. Not to exercise it is nothing to boast about.
Listeners, I'd like to hear from you on your reaction not only to that call, but now in retrospect, if it takes on a different poignance. Did you vote? Do you know folks who didn't vote and chose not to? As Shamika said, this wasn't a case where she wished she could have. She did not feel she had a choice, and she chose not to vote. 844-295-TALK, toll-free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. We're exploring some of the lessons of this election and the way forward with Dr. Marvin McMickle from Colgate-Rochester Crozer Divinity School. And Dr. McMickle, we took a little more time with Shamika that day before we let the call go because I wanted to explore with her more of the mindset because I asked her, okay, you didn't feel you had a good presidential choice. But what about local elections? That's so much where our societies are built. She said she didn't feel she has a voice in a local election. She doesn't feel represented on the local level, on the state level. She doesn't feel there are choices that she wanted to exercise in the voting booth. But she said she tries to stay active in her community in terms of she's engaged and she's a participant in local media, local journalism, things like that. That there are different ways for her, or local radio, to engage the community. She just didn't feel that voting, whether it was for this presidential election or any other stage, mattered. And I'm trying to get inside the mindset there. So, because I know you disagree with that idea that she was expressing. But why do you think people like Shamika got to November 8th not feeling inspired to even be registered to vote?
Well, it is for me impossible to comprehend. But now let's begin from the notion that this is a generational distinction. So I want to tell you a story, if I might, and your listeners. I have a great uncle that I discovered in a genealogical study. His name was Edward Donaghy from Kentucky. He was born in Kentucky in 1870. In 1930, he went to register to vote for the first time. It took him 60 years to get the courage to go. This was in Madison County, Kentucky. He went to the registrar and said he had come to vote. He was told that Inns, I won't use the full word, Inns cannot vote in Kentucky. He said, well, I've come to change that. And then he was told that Inns do not vote in Kentucky. And then the third time he asked to register to vote, he was shot dead by the registrar right on the spot. They took the registrar to jail. He pled self-defense against an unarmed man and was released without any charge, without any consequence. 1930, black people were being shot on the spot for daring to lay claim to the right to vote. Now their great-grandchildren are walking away from the right to vote because they don't have their preferred candidate or because they don't think that this person is as aggressive as they wish they would be. I understand her frustration. I only hope that she will understand the frustration of my generation in her answer that too much work went into getting the right to vote to so glibly and callously cast it aside and to say that you don't have anyone to vote for. By not voting, we get Donald Trump's cabinet. By not voting, we get Donald Trump. By not voting, she doesn't have any position from which to push back because she cannot say, well, you weren't my candidate, I voted for somebody else. No. She walked out of the process, and I'm sure there were many, many others as well. But if you're not invested in it as a struggle, if you didn't work hard to get it, then you don't value it. The harder you worked to get it, and the more you remember what life was like before you didn't have it, the less likely you are to do that.
No matter how they would have voted, is it heartbreaking for you to think about all the people of color in this country who could have voted and did not on November 8th?
Not just November the 8th. In 1968, Richard Nixon defeated Hubert Humphrey by less than 500,000 votes. I kind of count the shift in American culture with that 68 election. More than a million and a half African-American voters didn't vote in 1968. So the Nixon era, which gave way to the Ford era, which gave way to the Reagan era, which gave way to the Bush era, which has given way to the Reagan era, all of that can be laid upon the feet of people who chose not to vote. So this year, when people decided that they didn't have anything to vote for, it is a continuation, frankly, of what has been happening in this country for almost 50 years, the results of which have been catastrophic for the very people who chose not to vote.
Let me grab our first phone call, and this is Bill in Rochester. I'm with Dr. Marvin McMichael. Go ahead, Bill.
Hey, guys. I agree with the guest's point on not voting and how it's kind of absurd to complain when you don't actually speak your mind in the voting. But I'm amazed at how earlier in the year the Bernie Sanders run, you know, was credited with bringing so many of a young generation into the process, which we didn't, a lot of my generation or the younger people, they didn't even follow through with their own zeal for the American process and democracy. I think that a lot of the Bernie Sanders voters dropped out when they felt their choice wasn't available, and I think that the idealistic nature of saying that, well, my vote will actually change everything is it's a little overstating what the process is of a country as a whole. I think that Bernie Sanders did bring a lot of people into it, but once they felt that it wasn't a possibility, they just said, I don't care anymore. I think a lot of them should blame themselves if they want to complain about Trump. And I know people that were all about for Bernie, and they tell me they didn't vote in the election for anybody. And it's just, you know, the third party thing is, yeah, I get it. That's a stance, but it's also, I guess it's better than not voting, but they still kind of contributed to the situation we're in now. And who knows, you know, if Russia really influenced this, maybe we couldn't have changed it. But I just think that our generation has a lot to learn from the older generation of, like your guest, who says, like, the history of voting. And, I mean, we live in Rochester, New York, where freedom and civil rights and voting rights, we're an epicenter for this. And our people should be a little bit more take a longer stance and a longer view of everything. So I agree with the guest, and you guys always have great conversations about this. I listen to it all the time.
Thank you, Bill. Thanks for the phone call.
I appreciate it. Yeah.
You know, let me just kind of work backwards through some of what Bill had to say there, Dr. McMichael. He invoked Russia, and I don't want to speak out of school. Did you mention before the hour began in conversation that you're aware, and I don't even know, a signatory on at least some concern about maybe halting or at least pausing as we...
Yes.
Okay, so could you explain?
So Nancy Pelosi, who is the House Minority Leader, was circulating through an online platform called change.org, a petition asking people to sign on to delay the meeting of the Electoral College on the 19th and delay the actual date of the inauguration until all of these investigations about whether or not and to what extent Russians hacked into the American political system, primarily by hacking in only to Democratic candidates and Democratic parties. So all the WikiLeaks stuff that was coming out in the last few weeks of the campaign. So, yeah, I mean, I think there is a real strong concern that the electoral process may have lacked some integrity. What would have happened if those WikiLeaks had not come out? This may not change the outcome at all, but I think the idea of investigating it, which, by the way, yesterday, even the Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell agreed with, as did Paul Ryan, if there has been foreign intervention into the American electoral process, we've got to find out what's going on, because if we don't, the integrity of every subsequent election can be called into question.
When it comes to what Congress is doing, you know, some of the complaints in recent days have been Congress called more hearings on Benghazi than they have on foreign intervention in American elections. Maybe that will change going forward. I would implore any listener right now, and I say this as sort of in the generous spirit of conversation as I can, call and explain to me how you feel when you hear that Congress has decided to quietly shut down investigating Benghazi. Hillary Clinton was defeated, and they're not even going to investigate anymore. It's over. They're not going to have any more hearings. They're done with this. If this wasn't a political tool, if you cared about what happened there, it doesn't matter who's elected or not, right? You continue to hold hearings. You continue to search for the justice that you say you seek. Why are you shutting this down after an election? How can you say to me that this was not political? And again, I'm not, maybe those who supported those hearings wanted to see more come out of it. The concern is that when we see things overly politicized, right now we have a country, Dr. McMichael, where it feels like it's FBI versus the CIA. That doesn't feel healthy. Mm-hmm. That should not be, those should not be politicized organizations. So are you concerned, though, that if there's hearings going forward on Russia, that they must be bipartisan if they're going to be respected?
Oh, absolutely. Otherwise, it does become a political tool. Now, of course, the CIA and the FBI have squared up on one issue. Both of them absolutely agree, along with 15 other intelligence agencies, that there was Russian involvement in the selection. The only person who's saying no is the president-elect, who is the least qualified to understand intelligence briefings because he's not going to get any.
He's not receiving them.
So here is your entire intelligence apparatus, 17 separate agencies, all telling you, we can say beyond the shadow of a doubt that the Russian government was trying to manipulate the electoral process. And the president-elect says, oh, I think it could just as easily have been a guy in New Jersey sitting on a park bench. So from the beginning, it looks as if the tension is going to be between the White House and all of the intelligence apparatus. But yes, I think to the extent that we investigate this, it does have to be bipartisan. Now, Jason Chaffetz, who's the chair of the House Investigative Committee, said that he was going to continue investigations against Hillary Clinton if she won, beginning on the day after the election. If it was that important, and that's his own word, why didn't he continue those investigations the day after the election? Because she lost. That was really the goal all along, was to defeat her. And the only thing, by the way, that Congress was more focused on than Benghazi was the 52 votes to cancel Obamacare.
Let me also ask you about what's coming up on Monday. On Monday, the Electoral College formally votes, and the electors will make it official whom the next president will be. Larry Lessig, Harvard Law professor, has been sort of at the forefront of this movement to try to convince, I think, 37 or 38 Republican electors to change their vote. And at the very least, Larry Lessig is right when he says they have the right to. They certainly do. They are pledged to vote for whomever their state chose based on the rules that their state set up, but they are not by law required to. I'm curious to know, though, Dr. McMichael, if somehow Monday comes to pass that the Electoral College decides by a margin of one or two votes that they get 40, let's say they get 40 Republican electors to change, what would happen? I mean, do you fear what would happen?
I do. I fear what Trump and Trump's followers would seek to manipulate, to have happen. Don't forget that he was saying all along that the election process is rigged and that if things did not work out the way he thought they should, there could be riots in the street. Again, his own words. If he were to have won the vote on the 9th of November, and then a month and a half later, it is taken away by what would be a legal process, I do think there would be some major civil unrest. It would take a really almost miraculous intervention for that to happen. But I signed a petition, not so much for them to change their vote, as to delay their vote until, as they have requested, they can be briefed on these charges of Russian intervention. So if you've got members of the Electoral College saying, we don't want to cast this vote until we can find out what's going on, I'm really in favor of that. Now, if all of that is done and they still vote the way it appears they will, that's the process. So I wouldn't... But at some point, I think we have to have a real discussion about how Hillary Clinton can win the popular vote by 2.5 million votes and still lose.
I think it's closer to 3 million votes
now.
Yeah.
This is wacky. This is the second time that a Democrat has won the election and lost.
Speaking of California, can you finish counting? I mean, it's been 5 weeks. When are we going to get done counting in California? What's going on there? Robert in Fairport next on the phone. Go ahead, Robert.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Hey, one thing that... kind of bugged me during the primary season was that they have these super delegates in the Democratic primary, and I just never understood the role of a super delegate. I mean, it seems like a delegate alone would be enough. It seems that the super delegate role was kind of to change the outcome just in case it didn't go the way they wanted it to. The other thing, too, about the popular vote, it kind of reminds me a little bit of football. You can play a game, a football game, the final score is what counts, but as being a Bills fan so many years, you know, one team may outgain another, the Bills may have a lot of yards rushing and still lose the game, and that kind of is what happened with the popular vote.
Yeah, I actually think that's
a good analogy.
That's a good analogy.
Yeah, that's a very good analogy.
Robert, thank you for the phone call. On the subject of superdelegates, the Democratic Party has got to get rid of those, don't they? That was this a ceremonial perk, but it doesn't look very democratic when you're saying that they could circumvent the will of people.
Yeah. Well, you know, superdelegates were and are primarily elected officials scattered across the country who are the first ones that potential candidates approach for their support in the hope that those endorsements and that level of influence will, you know, work its way down. But if the mayor is there, if the member of Congress is there, if the state senators are there, surely this is beefing up the candidate's luster. But to the extent that it is perceived as tilting the election away from the will of the majority, then I think on the one hand there is the question of the Electoral College versus the popular vote and a regular delegate versus a superdelegate. Anything in the public mind that seems to suggest that my vote counts less, I think is a bad thing for our democracy.
Let's get our only break of the hour, and we come back with Dr. Marvin McMickle. I'll read an email from a listener who says they have a reason for not voting, and they want to push back a little on what they're hearing today. Listeners, if you want to call the program, it's 844-295-TALK. Toll free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. The more I hear your voices and Dr. McMickle, the less you have to hear my fading late year voice that's just hanging in there. He's here. He's the president of Colgate Rochester Crozer Divinity School for the hour, and we continue next on Connections. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. A couple of emails and a couple of phone calls, and I'm going to start with Judy, who writes and says, "We live in interesting times, uncharted territory. I feel that Trump will disappoint many. He will delegate duties, including his lack of interest in security briefings. He will put his foot in his mouth as he has no filters." She says Michael Moore predicts Trump will not finish his term due to some kind of illegal act. Hopefully he will not do too much harm. 4 years, nothing lasts forever. So Judy is closing her email with similar to what you wrote about on November 9th in the Democrat and Chronicle, which is it's 4 years in front of us, nothing lasts forever, that our country has survived really remarkably difficult things. Mm-hmm. But she's also, you know, invoking Michael Moore's prediction that we won't see Trump for 4 years. What do you make of that?
Well, there are two possibilities. Possibility one is that he could be impeached on the emoluments clause. Mm-hmm. Yesterday he said that he was postponing the decision to announce how he plans to separate himself from his businesses. Today it was announced that both of his sons were involved in screening potential cabinet nominees. His daughter is moving to Washington to work closely with him in the White House. So exactly how is he going to separate his role as president from their role as running the business if, in fact, they are already intimately involved in that process? So he is setting himself up for a constitutional crisis. Does the Congress have the courage to push him on the language of the Constitution itself? So he could be impeached, you know, if he doesn't do something compelling. The other is that he could, in fact, resign from office, decide that this is not what he really wants to do, pass the baton to Mike Pence. They get a new vice president. Pence, who is getting security briefings every day. It does begin to make you wonder whether or not the reason Trump is not going and Mike Pence is because in the long run, Trump doesn't even want the job. I don't think he was running to win from the beginning. I think he is as amazed as I am that he won.
Okay.
And now, you know, what am I going to do? Like that movie called The Candidate with Robert Redford years ago, where he runs for the U.S. Senate. He wins. And the last line of the movie is, "Now what do I do?"
Well, let me read Harry's email in regards to pushing back a little. And he didn't like what he heard earlier from Dr. McMickle on the fact that Dr. McMickle thinks if you don't vote, you have voted, in effect. Harry writes, "I just want to comment on your guest's didactic and condescending argument about voting. I think people did not vote for a variety of reasons. excuse me, I personally know people who did not vote in the general election because they were turned away at the voting booth during the primary because they are independent Bernie Sanders supporters. Your guest is also fetishizing the function of the vote, which validates a democracy in which a lot of us are not flourishing. I also want to point out that voting is not the only way we can participate in politics, and blaming the last few decades of conservative victory on those who are discouraged to vote is not only unfair, but a simplification, a grotesque simplification of the leftist defeat. That's from Harry.
Well, I disagree, almost word for word. Not to vote is to vote. You have, by not casting your ballot, made a conscious decision to walk away from the process and let those who do vote have the last word. In point of fact, non-voter participation over the last 50 years is disproportionately the reason why certain candidates have won. This election swung on 80,000 votes in five different states. When Michelle Obama was campaigning and she said one vote per political precinct is how her husband won the election, and that if one vote per precinct had voted differently or had not voted, he would not have won. So, you know, voting in the primary is a different question because you don't get a conservative or a Green Party or a, other kind of ballot. It's, are you a Democrat or a Republican? You could have written in, I suppose, Bernie Sanders' name if you wanted to. But the idea that it is condescending to suggest that there is justification for not voting, I don't think it's condescending at all. I think it's revelatory. There are other ways to voice yourself. Black Lives Matter was a street-level protest. They voiced their opinion. Writing letters to the editor, going to community forums, all of these are ways to do it. None of them have a direct outcome, however, on the selection of the nation's next president. There's only one way to do that.
Now, what if Harry or others who may agree with him, Chamika, whose call we played earlier, what if they were to say, but Dr. McMickle, certainly in looking at the outcome and looking at Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, we could understand that there are differences, mm-hmm. that there will be differences in governing. There will be different outcomes for different people. But what if they were to say, we accept that, but perpetuating the old system got us a watered-down version of the justice they seek, a watered-down version of the equality they seek, instead of a full-throated appeal for the values that they stand up for, and that their concern was maybe Hillary Clinton would have been more effective than Donald Trump, but not to the extent that they think this country deserves, and their concern was perpetuating that kind of a system. I think that's kind of what I'm hearing from Harry and others, to say, we didn't want to perpetuate that because it is not good enough.
So what do they get? What's the consequence? By voting that way or by acting that way, this is what they got. So I want to just read this. I just want to read to Harry this list. The nominee for the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, is a climate change denier. The Secretary of Labor is against raising the minimum wage. The Secretary of State is best friends with Vladimir Putin. The Secretary of Education is pro-charter schools. The Secretary of HUD is a brain surgeon who is against public housing. The Attorney General is against expanding voting rights. The National Security Advisor thinks it's legitimate to be suspicious of all Muslims. The Commerce Secretary is into buying low and selling high in terms of small businesses. The HHS Health and Human Services Director is anti-abortion and anti-Obamacare. The Secretary of Treasury is from Goldman Sachs and is singularly responsible for the housing bust of 2008. That's what we got with Donald Trump. That's not what we would have gotten with Hillary Clinton. And Harry and the other persons who didn't vote will have to own these people.
Okay. Well, I understand the point you're making, Dr. McMickle. Now, on the subject of abortion, you know, we've heard from, and on this program, and by the way, Carl, who just emailed to say, You know, you never invite Trump supporters on the program. Baloney. You've heard plenty since the election, if you've been listening, including a panel of women who supported Donald Trump, largely on grounds that they are hopeful Roe v. Wade is overturned. Dr. McMickle, there's a sizable part of the population that has some enthusiasm about that possibility, that we could be looking at the end of Roe v. Wade and a real, real shift in reproductive rights in this country.
There was a vote yesterday in the state I formerly resided in for 24 years, which is Ohio.
Yeah, me too. It's where I grew up, yeah.
Yeah, where John Kasich vetoed what they call a heartbeat bill, that you cannot perform an abortion if you can hear the heart beating, which is like within the first 4 weeks.
Five or 6 weeks, yeah.
Yeah, but he did sustain a 20-week ban. I think the nation is and long has been caught up in a very intense debate about abortion. I think people simply need to ask themselves the question of what is going to happen if that is taken away. Women are going to continue to seek reproductive choice. They may end up having to do it at their own expense. They may end up having to do it in the back alley, or those doctors who do it may end up having to go to jail. If Roe v. Wade is overturned by the Supreme Court and the next appointee could decide that, the point of fact is two-thirds of the American public is for Roe v. Wade, not against it. And I think we have to ask ourselves whether or not that's a step in a positive direction. But all I'm saying is that's the position of the person who is being nominated for HHS, but also not only does he want to overturn Roe v. Wade, he also wants to throw out Obamacare and the 20 million people who now have health care. So all I'm saying is take the whole list, take out whichever ones you agree with, but consider all the rest and ask yourself if that's the change you're looking for.
All right, one more question on the cabinet, and then I'll go back to phone calls here. Donald Trump did appoint an African-American to HUD, Dr. Ben Carson, and the question that a lot of people have is if he is going to be a friend to justice and equality when it comes to housing rights and housing opportunity. And I wonder how you feel about that.
Ben Carson is on record as being opposed to government intervention in setting aside federal revenues for housing. But more importantly, he has absolutely no experience in government policy. Ben Carson said, "I do not want to be added to the cabinet." This was before he was, because I don't think that I'm qualified for any position in the cabinet.
Maybe he was just being modest.
I don't think so. I don't think Ben Carson has any public policy experience. He was a brilliant, brilliant neurosurgeon. But being a brilliant neurosurgeon does not translate into being the head of an 80,000-member bureaucracy whose fundamental goal is to make sure that housing is available and affordable for the American public, and I might add that housing, particularly public housing, is not concentrated. Now, that's the issue here in Rochester.
Of course.
It's the concentration of housing, and it is the resistance of certain communities to have public housing present in their neighborhoods. Is he going to fight for that? I don't have any reason to think so.
Yeah, we have a very poor track record of justice when it comes to housing, whether it's redlining and what happened to so many families, mm-hmm. or when it comes to that concentration that in our community, as Ed Doherty has told us so many
times,
over
and over again,
is so concentrated as to be the kind of community where when you look at the overall stats of Rochester, if you just look at statistics, that's why some people think, well, I can't go to the city of Rochester. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't feel safe there.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of the crime and a lot of the poverty is so concentrated because of what has been done with this. And I guess it sounds like you think the next administration, we're not going to see progress there.
I'd like somebody to show me why I should think differently.
Yeah.
By any of these appointments, including his.
Can local efforts circumvent that?
Well, only if neighborhoods are willing to be more absorbent. In other words, if we can get away from the not in my backyard attitude and say, yes, yeah, some reasonable, proportionate use of mixed-use housing in various towns around Monroe County, but that will require the county executive and the county administration, running the risk of even raising the conversation.
It's not always an easy conversation.
Just to raise it.
Yeah. Back to the phones we go. Josh in Rochester next up with Dr. Marvin McMichael. Go ahead, Josh.
Hey, I was just calling because the caller seems to think the only way that your voice counts is if you vote. Yet Hillary Clinton won New York State by, I think, double-digit leads, and Donald Trump lost the national popular vote by like 2.5 million votes. So I was just wondering how you address that when I didn't vote, but if I had voted, it wouldn't have made a difference, and it would just have been another vote counting towards the wrong candidate.
Okay.
It's probably important to explain how this works. The popular vote is the gross number of people who voted. The Electoral College is the number of congressional districts in every state across the whole country. So if you could win New York State by 5 million more votes than your opponent, you do not get any more electoral votes. You just got a bigger popular vote, but you don't get any more electors. So what happened was that while she won big in New York, she won big in California, big population centers, she won big in Illinois, she did not win enough states. So granted, your vote in the state of New York would not have helped her get any more electoral votes because that's a flat number. Across the whole country, the number of persons who chose not to vote in any of the remaining states is a fundamental problem. She lost the Electoral College in 4 or 5 states across the so-called Rust Belt of this country, Michigan, Ohio, Indiana, Pennsylvania,
Wisconsin
yeah. By 80,000 votes. If the people in Milwaukee, just Milwaukee, had voted in bigger numbers, she would have won Wisconsin. If the people in suburban Detroit had voted in bigger numbers, she would have won. If the people in Columbus and Cleveland had voted in bigger numbers, she would have won in Ohio. So it may be true that for you, singularly, in New York State, the case holds, you know, some weight. In other states, I think the outcome would have been substantially different.
All right, Craig and Kendall, next up on the phones. Go ahead, Craig.
Hi there. I just, going back to something earlier in the program, I didn't hear the very intro of it, but I did want to say that I'm in my 60s, and I've voted almost every presidential election, and rarely have I had a candidate that I wanted to vote for. But I have always known who I didn't want. And I have always voted against them, except I think the first time I voted for Mickey Mouse, right? You know? When I was young, you know? It's like, when I started thinking about that later, I thought, maybe I'm not. And occasionally I've had somebody I really wanted in there. Okay? And this past time, my son was a Bernie supporter, okay? And when Bernie didn't win the primary and stuff, he was upset, and he's going to vote against Hillary and all that. And I talked to him about it. He ended up voting against who he didn't want, okay? The most likely place to put his vote to make sure that it got against the person he didn't want. And I just want to mention that to the listeners that didn't vote. You don't always have to vote for who you want, but you usually will know who you don't want. And it's best to vote against that party.
Craig, thanks for that. Just because, Dr. McMichael, so often we hear people say, well, don't vote against something. You should be voting for something. Mm-hmm. Craig is saying, well, it's still useful occasionally to vote against something.
Yeah. I mean, if you've got the lesser of two evils, which I think many people in America felt, that neither one was the ideal candidate for them. And a number of African-American people said to me, I'm not going to vote because an African-American is not on the ballot. You know, I was fired up for Obama in 08. I was fired up in 12. She is not him. I'm dropping out. Yeah, okay. But I think your caller has made a good point. If you're not positively and enthusiastically voting for someone, are these two people equal? Is their vision of America similar? Will 4 years of the administration result in the same outcomes, or does one seem to have an approach to governance and foreign policy and personal conduct with which you feel fundamentally uncomfortable? Then I think at that point it is perfectly acceptable to vote against somebody that you think would do harm to the common good.
Dr. McMichael, we've seen your writings, your essays in the Democrat and Chronicle. We have you on this show. And Matt on Twitter says, I thought Rochester Colgate Crozier Divinity School was an institution where one studies topics concerning divinity, not politics. You want to respond to his comment?
Yeah,
there?
I don't think that you can be a theologian or a Christian preacher if you are not immensely aware of and engaged in public affairs, because you have to do your ministry within the public sphere. You don't just preach, you know, some esoteric biblical reflection to people who live in, you know, live in isolation from the world. We have to help people function in the world in which they live, and we have to train students to help them to function. And one of the areas in which that is the case is with political dialogue and social and public policy. So we very much encourage our students to be not only aware of, but engaged with those kinds of issues
and to disagree with you on occasion,
which they students do. Bear in mind, the older I get and the younger they are, the more likely these sorts of generational conflicts will pop up, and I have to hear them out. All I can say is, you know, this is where I am, this is who I am, this is what I believe. I will only challenge you to the point that I think that your fundamental premise is wrong. If your strategy is different from mine, that's okay.
All right, Dave in Rochester, we got to keep it tight. Go ahead, Dave.
Yes, hello. I just wanted to comment that you're focusing, I think, on the wrong elections. I mean, every four-year elections, yes, they're important, but I think too many people locally ignore the local elections. If you were at the budget vote last night for the County Ledge, I mean, those are on programs that will have a very big impact on the residents of the county and the community itself. So I'd rather have, you know, in terms of building a democracy, you got to start local, I think, and work your way up.
I think that's well said, Dave. What do you think, Dr. McMichael?
No, I think that's right. I think the Republican Party became the dominant political force by concentrating on off-year elections, school board elections, state legislative elections, city council elections, so that they had power and control from the grassroots up, and therefore there was no place to turn. The appointment of judges, the nomination of people to fill various public service roles. Yeah, I don't think that you should just vote every 4 years. You ought to vote every time there's an election.
Democrats have been rolled in state elections, state legislatures. The state houses are very red, not very blue now. Yeah, no, they Republicans have been remarkably successful on, well, now, every single level. I mean, Democrats are really sort of in the wilderness here. Last question for you then, and I'll just tell our listeners, if I can have Dr. McMichael back with some frequency, we'll do that, because the phone's always lit up, and I know our community loves engaging with you. About 90 seconds left here, and you brought up Black Lives Matter. That's a movement that, you know, Hillary Clinton during the campaign at one point met with representatives of the Boston chapter and said, you know, what you need is an agenda, that the gay rights movement didn't have success until there was an agenda. Well, Black Lives Matter is now able to say to Hillary Clinton and others, there is an agenda. We do have aims and goals here. But how do you see it, this movement under the Trump administration now?
It's impossible to say, because I don't know who he is from day to day. He may well receive a group one day, but not follow through on the policies the next. One thing is for sure. The fundamental problem has to be the way in which police officers are trained when they encounter African-American persons, not to shoot first. And African-American communities have to understand that every time there is a shooting of a police officer, it heightens the tension between the two groups. So there has to be conversation going back and forth from both constituencies, African-American communities, law enforcement communities, so that each of them can hear the other out.
You think that's going to, I mean, we've had the president-elect, we've had him saying he wants stop and frisk on a national level.
It failed in New York. It's going to fail everywhere.
That's right. Yeah. And if that happens, I think that doesn't really bridge some of the divide.
Yeah, no. His whole convention was a law and order convention. And to elevate the sheriff from Milwaukee County, you know, who, because he's African-American, he thinks can persuade the rest of us that getting tough is the way to go, I think, is the fundamental flaw.
Can you come back sometime soon?
Whenever
sir?
You'd like. Sure.
Dr. Marvin McMichael is the president of Colgate Rochester Crozer Divinity School, and we always appreciate his time and his perspective here. And for Carl and others, you know, what you're hearing from Dr. McMichael is one perspective and one big, broad community. And you've been hearing lots of perspectives from since the election, and you'll hear a lot more. So let's get our only break and come back with more Connections next.